The president has issued a memorandum of notification giving CIA the power to capture and detain suspected terrorists on the battlefield.
Detain them where? Are we bringing them to the U.S.?
We're really not in the prison business over counterterrorism.
Look, the budget for counterterrorism last week was what? $600 million? The budget this week is whatever you need it to be. And we are in whatever business it takes to get the job done.
Welcome to The Report, a companion podcast to the movie The Report. I'm Kelly McEvers, host of the NPR podcast Embedded, and this is episode 2. Okay, so I want to start this part of the story with what is in a lot of ways the origin of the CIA torture program. September 11th, 2001. A day that is, of course, forever linked to images of planes crashing into the World Trade Center. But it's important to remember that New York City was just one of the targets that terrorists hit on September 11th. Washington, D.C. was also under attack.
There was an unbelievable sense of fear in the United States, and particularly in Washington.
Jane Mayer is an investigative reporter and chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. She's also the author of the book The Dark Side, the story of how the war on terror turned into the war on American ideals.
My office was not far from the White House, and I ran over there after the Twin Towers in New York had been hit, and the Pentagon was hit. You could see the smoke on the horizon. There were rumors that the State Department was a target, and there were rumors that Congress had been a target and the White House. People had run so fast out of the White House. You could see shoes littered on the sidewalks out in front of it because they'd run right out of their shoes. The sense of fear that dominated the Capitol was terrifying. And it's in that atmosphere, kind of a desperate kind of feeling situation, that these policymakers were meeting with the president, who was looking for fast answers and something he could tell the country and some way to get the blame off his back.
In the weeks after September 11th, a clearer picture started to emerge of what happened or didn't happen inside the government agencies whose job it was to prevent an attack like September 11th.
So there's this fascinating run-up to 9/11 that I think probably played a very big part in pushing the government in this terrible direction. And people don't pay that much attention to it. But basically, what happens when you have an attack like the 9/11 one, which was a gigantic intelligence failure and a huge embarrassment and a tragedy for the U.S. When something like that happens, the first thing that the dynamic in politics is blame. Who's responsible for this? And what happened was that within the government, there had been a number of people who actually should have done a lot better. There was all kinds of bureaucratic bungling. They dropped the ball. There were many warnings. People said things like their hair was on fire, but they still didn't really do anything to stop Al-Qaeda.
It quickly became clear the CIA had dropped the ball. The agency had information on two of the 9/11 hijackers, but failed to act in ways that might have saved lives.
So what does that do when, as soon as you have an attack like this, all of this dirty laundry is going to come out and it's going to implicate a lot of people and they're going to try to shift the blame? And what happened here was also they're going to want to look really tough, like they're not weak, they didn't mess up, we're going to be cowboys and we're going to go make it right. And that's kind of the mindset that was taking place.
Another thing that became clear after 9/11 was that there was a very dysfunctional relationship between two of the agencies most responsible for keeping America safe, the FBI and the CIA.
Just think a little bit about what that dynamic results in. You have people at the CIA who have a horrible sense of blame, and of responsibility, and having drop the ball on something this important. Nearly 3,000 Americans died in these attacks, and they never managed to even inform their colleagues at the FBI about what they knew before it. So they practically panic right after 9/11.
At the time, George Tenet was the director of the CIA. He'd been running the agency since 1996. Years after he retired, the CIA's inspector general issued its own report, which said that Tenet was aware of the threat of al-Qaeda, but failed to act on that intelligence. The report concluded that Tenet bears ultimate responsibility for the agency's failures.
And I have a scene in the book where George Tenet is basically getting the information. They've gone back to look through their files, and they suddenly realize, oh, my God, we had this information, the names of two of these hijackers. We never told the FBI. And he just sort of reels back in his chair and says, we're fucked. And some of the same people who so screwed up before 9/11 soon are in charge of trying to make it right. And you can see they're going to overcompensate. I personally think part of the reason that they got into this torture program was they so overcompensated. They were so, had such a sense of shame that they literally were going to beat it out of people if they could to try to make it right.
To understand how the CIA dropped the ball, it helps to know the differences between the CIA and the FBI.
The CIA's territory was global, and the FBI's was domestic inside the borders of the U.S., and they were supposed to somehow, you know, keep in their own lanes. But when you think about it, what happened with al-Qaeda was you had a global terrorist operation that penetrated the U.S. So it was both of their responsibilities. And the problem was they weren't talking to each other. Each of them was guarding their own turf and guarding their own information. And that resulted in one of the big problems, which was that the CIA had gotten early reports that suggested that two of the hijackers had come into the United States and had multiple entry visas that allowed them to just stay in the United States. This is before 9/11. And the CIA failed to mention this unbelievably important fact to the FBI. And so the FBI had no way to follow up on it. And, you know, it's hard to tell still to this day. Did it fall through the cracks? Was it a matter of the CIA hoarding information purposefully? It was just a tragic mistake. And that rivalry continues on after the attack because both of them think that they are better at handling the situation and interrogating the terror suspects. And so they start to fight over who gets in the room.
Let's talk about this room, because this is where the CIA first enters the picture, right? Coming in for the first time on the FBI's interrogation of a subject. And it's the first time the CIA will use its new so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, or EITs, on a detainee named Abu Zubaydah, who they think is a key player in 9/11.
They're saying he's the fourth or fifth lieutenant to bin Laden. He knew all about all the different attacks, including the 9/11 attack. And so they think they've got a really major haul here. He's been egregiously wounded. He's been shot in the thigh, in the stomach, and in the testicle. You've got an FBI agent, Ali Soufan, who knows a lot about al-Qaeda and terrorism and is fluent in Arabic. And the FBI's approach to interviewing or interrogating suspects is one that's very within the United States law. They're in the habit of trying to get information in a way that will allow them to eventually help prosecute suspects within the rule of law in America. So they don't want to do anything that's going to shock the conscience of the court. Ali Soufan's there. He starts trying to build rapport with Abu Zubaydah. And before long, he's really got him talking. And Abu Zubaydah tells him quite a few interesting things. Ali Soufan shows him a picture book with photos of various possible al-Qaeda suspects. And Zubaydah recognizes one man in particular who he describes as Mukhtar. And this lets the FBI know that this man, Mukhtar, who is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is a major force in al-Qaeda and a major planner of the 9/11 attack. And that's incredibly important information. The FBI learned some other things, too. They learn about some other attacks that may be underway, including one involving a suspect named Jose Padilla, who had a plan to use some kind of dirty bomb in the United States, I think in New York. So Ali Soufan feels he's really getting some good information.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Okay, we are back. Here's where I want to bring Daniel Jones into the story. Daniel was the lead investigator for the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report, and he was one of the first people outside the CIA to find out about this program. He went through 6.3 million pages of CIA classified documents during the course of the investigation, and he organized the investigation by going through the program detainee by detainee, starting with the first, a man named Abu Zubaydah.
So Abu Zubaydah is captured, he's shot, he's taken to a detention site. His condition then worsens to a degree in which they can no longer provide the medical care he needs for him to survive at the detention site. They relocate him to a hospital. The FBI continues to interrogate Abu Zubaydah in the hospital. At a certain point, he's unable to speak, but he's still pointing to things of the alphabet to spell things out for these FBI officers.
I just want to jump in here and underline this because it's very important and it will come into play later. A lot of the information the CIA said was the most valuable information that they got from Abu Zubaydah actually came from FBI interrogations that did not involve any torture whatsoever.
So he's being interrogated in the hospital room. And during that period of time, there are meetings at CIA headquarters about the way to interrogate Abu Zubaydah. And someone, a lawyer in the counterterrorism division, says, hey, I have a family member who works in something called the Office of Technical Services. And she knows these two guys who've written a paper about resistance techniques to interrogation. We should talk to them. And those people turn out to be Mitchell and Jessen.
Jim Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were the architects of the CIA torture program. We're going to go deep on both of them in the next episode. But for now, I'll ask, after the CIA decided to use Mitchell and Jessen's enhanced interrogation techniques on Abu Zubaydah, do Mitchell and Jessen just fly right out?
Initially, Jim Mitchell is just serving in an observational capacity in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. They then put Abu Zubaydah in isolation for 47 days. And during that period of time, Mitchell goes back to the United States. CIA is involved in this maneuvering to get both policy approval for these enhanced interrogation techniques and legal approval for those techniques. Jim Mitchell says, if we're going to do this, I want to bring in my partner who wrote this paper on resistance interrogations, Bruce Jessen. At that point, they get the legal approval and policy approval, and both Bruce Jessen and Jim Mitchell deploy to the detention site. And they are the ones, not other CIA officers, they are the ones who actually apply these techniques to detainees.
It's at this point that Mitchell flies to the CIA secret prison where Abu Zubaydah is and begins this experimental program using what the CIA calls enhanced interrogation techniques. And this is the first time in his life that James Mitchell actually gets in the room with a detainee.
Mitchell and Jessen were psychologists who worked for the Department of Defense. They worked for the U.S. Air Force's Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape School, the SEER School. And that school exposes U.S. military personnel to, you know, among other things, coercive interrogation techniques that they might be subject to if they were taken prisoner in countries that do not recognize the Geneva Conventions.
So, for example, a country like North Korea?
Right. Let's say you're taken captive in North Korea and you're forced to stand with your hands above your head for days, or you are waterboarded. The exposure to the SEER school is really meant to give you a taste of what it might be like. The idea that the first time that you're tortured or abused isn't in the field, but it's actually in a training environment to understand how you will respond. And these techniques that Sears based on really are aimed at producing false confessions. Neither Mitchell nor Jessen, neither of these psychologists, had any experience as an interrogator. They never interrogated anyone. In fact, at the Sears School, they only observed these interrogations going on, nor did they have any specialized knowledge of Al-Qaeda or any background in terrorism or any regional, cultural, or linguistic expertise. And these guys eventually led the entire program. They came up with the entire enhanced interrogation program. Mitchell theorized that subjecting people to these techniques produced this learned helplessness and that this state of dependency would result in detainees becoming, you know, quote, compliant and cooperative. Learned helplessness is based off something that Marty Silliman did, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, which looked at dogs and electrifying a cage in which dogs were in, and that if you electrified one part of the cage, the dogs would jump over to the other side to avoid the electric shocks. But if you electrified both sides, the dogs got a sense of learned helplessness to the point where if you even opened the cage, the dogs would no longer walk out on their own.
So Mitchell had never applied any of his theories to humans before he got authorization from the CIA to interrogate high-level suspected terrorists?
It was merely a theory. It wasn't based off any science. Some people asked for information, right? Show us your data on this. And he never had any data.
So you have two psychologists who are incredibly underqualified for the job of interrogating suspected terrorists. And they walk in on a very seasoned, well-informed, Arabic-speaking FBI agent named Ali Soufan, and they basically say to him, we'll take this from here?
That's absolutely right.
What sort of questions were they asking him while they were torturing him?
There were two questions they repeatedly asked during the application of techniques, and that is, who are the operatives in the United States? And tell us more about the next attack. CIA thought they were in a ticking time bomb situation throughout all the years of this program. But over and over again, while waterboarding, while walling him, while applying these techniques, it was, who are the operatives in the United States, and where is the next attack? And of course, he didn't have that information.
Why didn't he have that information?
The CIA told the Department of Justice and the president that Abu Zubaydah was the third or fourth highest ranking member in Al-Qaeda. That was based off a source the CIA had access to. That source retracted that information in July of 2002. And of course, we know in August of 2002, Abu Zubaydah was subjected to the EITs.
And just to clarify, EITs, that's shorthand for enhanced interrogation techniques, which is longhand for torture.
CIA never told the Department of Justice that the source had retracted that. Abu Zubaydah was not even a member of Al-Qaeda. He did logistics at training camps that were unrelated to Al-Qaeda, but did have some contact with the group. He was the person you called if you wanted to go to training. He's the type of guy you'd give your passport to, your information. So when you look at it from a signals intelligence perspective, in other words, if you were to map Al-Qaeda all out and you were going to track all their telephones, you would see that there's this person in the middle who's getting a lot of phone calls, and it's Abu Zubaydah. And I think the CIA analysis was this must be the key ringleader of the agency. When in actuality, he was the guy you would call if you want to go to a training camp. He was the administrative assistant, in other words.
This seems like a pretty big intelligence failure.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it would be if you looked at an office building and you tracked all the phones and you'd say, who is this extremely important person who everybody is calling? And it turns out it's the front desk attendant. I don't want to say that Abu Zubaydah was useless. To the contrary, he produced a lot of useful intelligence to the FBI and others. And it was about administrative taskings, as if you'd taken, if your source in the White House was the person who took all the phone calls, that's a source you want, right? They can say, well, the president is connected to this person, but it's this person over here who called all the time. That's who you want to look at. Abu Zubaydah was very useful. I mean, there wasn't a period of time that Abu Zubaydah did not cooperate. You know, he provided information on what he knew about the structure of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda members, about training camps. He provided information about plots that he had heard about, but didn't have direct involvement in. But the CIA was convinced that he knew more.
So you have Abu Zubaydah. The FBI interrogates him and gets all this useful information that you just mentioned. Then the CIA takes over, convinced that he's this senior-ranking member of Al-Qaeda. He is tortured repeatedly, and then it turns out he isn't even a member of al-Qaeda. How did a mistake that big get made by the organization whose job it is to know these things?
This goes back to pre-9/11, the idea that the CIA failed to prevent those attacks and that they did not have a robust source network into al-Qaeda. In fact, so much of the information we knew about al-Qaeda was acquired by friendly liaison services around the world. When the CIA took custody of Abu Zubaydah, it was their only source. And they wanted to believe that this person could help them prevent the next attack. And it led to a lot of faulty analysis. And this is another part of that lack of accountability chain that we see over and over again. No one was ever held accountable for misrepresenting the importance of Abu Zubaydah in terms of whether or not he was even an al-Qaeda member.
This is a key point in the report's findings, right? That torture did not work. The CIA says it got all this useful information because it tortured Abu Zubaydah, but in truth, he had already given that information to the FBI, which did not engage in torture.
Yes, that's correct.
So there's this misconception about the torture program that I think continues to this day, right? And that was that it was a program that was created by Dick Cheney. And that's not true?
Right. There are a lot of misconceptions about where this program began and the White House's role in the program.
And that's what we're going to get into in the next episode of The Report. Amazon Studios' The Report is produced by Topic Studios and Western Sound. Executive producers for Topic Studios are Lital Molad and Lisa Leingang. Special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs. Executive producer for Western Sound is Ben Adair, and the producer is David Weinberg. Hannes Brown composed original music and mixed the show. Daniel Jones is executive producer and host. I'm Kelly McEvers. Thanks for listening.